Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, Black Herb America. How are you this week? We had a strange weekend, but before I get into that, I would just like to say that welcome, and my name is Kenny Jones.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be.
That was a little bit of Gil Scott-Heron. Yes, Black Herb America comes on Tuesday evenings, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. On Saturdays, we have Carl Steve with Provocative Thought. He also airs 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Also, we have a marketing partnership program that is for small business owners as well as self-employed individuals. We'll help you with your products and services to become more exposed to the national and international audience. Now, if you're interested in this marketing partnership program, you can contact 404-573-6144. As I was saying earlier, this was a strange week. This was a strange weekend, and my prayers and my wishes and my condolences go out to the Americans that were killed and injured in Las Vegas. We're living in a strange world now. We have instances of military conflict about to happen. We have this strange politics that's going on in the United States of America. But as always, America's lives on, and we fight through it. Tonight, we have a special guest. He's a D.C. correspondent, and he has over 25 years of management and sales in the Silicon Valley. Also, he hosts his own show called The Lion Chase, and his name is Mr. Lonnie Poindexter. Brother Lonnie, good evening. How are you?
I'm doing just fine, brother. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. You have a very, very interesting and impressive background. Could you just share a little bit more about yourself? Matter of fact, when I marketed the show about a half an hour ago, you know, a couple of people know who you are, and I follow you on Facebook as well. Matter of fact, how's your nephew, the one that had the brain aneurysm?
It's actually, excuse me, my first cousin, and he and I grew up together. And he had a brain aneurysm last week, and so we've been lifting prayers up for him. You know, he's a father, a husband, and a grandfather, and just a terrific human being, and was in reasonably good health and was at work and collapsed while at work. And one of his coworkers found him, and so they rushed him to the hospital, so he's been in intensive care ever since and has been unconscious, but we have some good reports. And I think it's because of all the prayers being lifted up from everyone across the nation for him, is that yesterday he began to move his arms and legs on his own. He still has not awakened from being unconscious, but they said that's a good sign. He's breathing on his own now. And my cousin Joe, he's quite a fighter, so we're believing that he's going to be able to pull on through this. But thank you for your concern, brother. Thank you.
Yeah, I told you I follow you on Facebook, and when I saw, I said, "Oh wow," you know. Tonight, can you tell a little bit more about yourself?
Sure, sure.
Remember,
really
it's only a one-hour show.
Right. No, I give you the Reader's Digest version. I really can't take any credit in it. It's for those of us who believe in a higher power and believe in a God above and His Son, it was He alone, when I look back on it, that the unseen hand of God, as it were. And so my formal background is I spent 20-plus years in Silicon Valley working for some of the preeminent names in Silicon Valley, household names that you would know, like Hewlett-Packard, Intel, and a lot of companies that you never heard of because they were absorbed once they went public by other companies. And then from that, I morphed into what I feel is my truer calling, which is being here in the nation's capital and functioning as a correspondent for Urban Family Talk Radio and as a national radio personality, which I have no formal training and background in. It just got opened some doors up, and I just said, okay, and I jumped in. So I host a show called Lion Chasers, and the show is based upon 1 Chronicles 11:22, which is the story about Benaiah, one of King David's mighty men, who went down in a pit on a snowing day and went one-on-one with a lion and prevailed. So the show is about uncommon men and women of faith who are not unafraid to speak truth in these interesting times and dark and evil days that we're in. So we're nationwide. We broadcast on both radio towers and also over the Internet, you know, much like blog radio. And and we have a listener reach of between 2.5 and 3 million listeners, and we're growing. We just picked up Columbia, Mississippi in July. Last year we picked up Memphis, Tennessee at 106.7. So you can catch us on various radio towers across the country.
That's great. Our topic tonight concerns religion and politics. I really going to add a little bit of twist to it that concerns African Americans. Now, before I really get to the question, what made you become a conservative? Have you always been conservative, or just in the last decade or so you became a conservative?
Well, I was raised with conservative values, as most, you know, African Americans have been. You know, we believe in God and country and faith in God, and we believe in our values are fairly conservative in terms of, you know, our communities. And that's what allowed us to prevail, even having the onslaught of slavery and second-class citizenship with Jim Crow and so forth. So I was raised, although my parents wouldn't call themselves conservative, that's certainly where I got my basic values. Now, my epiphany came in terms of party affiliation. Back when I was a businessman in Southern California, I was a part owner of a systems integration company down in Irvine, California. And we built that company, me and my childhood friend. I'm originally from Inglewood, California, for those of you listening from the West Coast in Southern Cal. And we took that company from about two or three employees up to about 20, 21 employees and doing about $1 million a year in sales and revenue back in the 80s, which was rare back then, especially having to have the darker paint job, having to be black. We did it in Lily White, South Orange County. And what happened was we ran afoul of the government there. We got behind on our payroll taxes. And because, you know, business, it's like you got projects that come in, money flows. When the projects aren't there, you've got to drum up more business. And we made arrangements to catch up with them with our payroll taxes. And lo and behold, one day they went into our business account and cleaned it out. So I had, 17, 18 employees looking at me, and my co-founder of the company side-eyed, thinking we'd run off with the money. So right then and there, I had my epiphany. I said, wait a minute. Okay, the bad guy ain't necessarily a white guy living in Orange County, but it's some guy driving a Crown Victoria saying he's from the government and he's here to help. So from that experience, I began to explore other viewpoints and had a chance to connect with actually a really good church that was in Southern California, began to teach me not only biblical worldview, but also political worldview. And that's when my change began.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. Why do you feel, it's said by the Pew Foundation, that somewhere up to 56% of the Republican Party includes faith-based compared to less than 40% of the Democratic Party. Why do the Republican Party welcomes religious thought?
Well, because if you look at the origins of the Republican Party, it was founded as a counter to the Democrat Party back not long after the forming of this nation. And so the Republican Party is a party historically of the abolitionists. It was a party of individuals that stood up against slavery, stood up against second-class citizenship and chattel slavery of folks that look like you and I. And that's its impetus. It was founded by clergy. Many pastors, including Mennonites and Amish and individuals like that. And so from that is the origins of the party originally moving forward. Now, the party has been more so and less than, as you know, both sides of the party throughout history. But if you look at from a religious standpoint, it's always been a party that was steeped in a, if you look at the party platform, not the individuals, look at the party platform, the platform has always stood for God and country. It's always stood for the rights of every individual. And historically going forward, just might note that every major piece of civil rights legislation back from the beginning of our nation, the beginning of the Republican Party, was birthed in and of the Republican Party. So for me, it was just a question of coming home. Now, I get a lot of rocks thrown at me for taking that stance, but I would say that conversely, and I was a Democrat at one time, just like most black folks, is that looking at the last 50 years, what has that party done for us as a people? And if you look at the statistics in our communities, if nothing else, you know, I tell people to become a Republican. I said, I tell them to really, really look at their party affiliation as to what that party has done for you as a people in your community. And you was up and close and personal, just look at Chicago.
Right. Chicago is really, really in desperate need of some type of gun control, especially in our communities. And I know that conservatives don't believe in gun control, but I mean, for what happened this past weekend and what's happened around this country with gun violence and just plain old violence, why do you think our country is erupting so violently lately? Like for the past 12 years.
Yeah, our country is moving further and further away from God. From a, if you look at it from a spiritual standpoint, and if you look at it from a secular worldview or even political worldview, the nation has lost its moorings. And because of that, the logical fallout of the things that you see, the tragic events, Vegas, we mentioned Chicago and St. Louis, Baltimore, and any other communities across the country, you know, gang violence is, violence due to using guns and so forth proliferates. But we must keep in mind that if you look back historically and biblically, that even if there wasn't gun violence, you know, the first recorded miracle was Cain slaying Abel, and he killed his brother with a rock. So at the end of the day, it's a sin thing.
Right.
And we must return to our roots. What made us great as a people and allowed us, I mean, look at what happened to, let me just go back. Look at what happened to the Indians. The Indians were nearly wiped off the face of this nation. Blacks came over here in slaves. Blacks came over here in slave ships, right?
Right.
Yet we prevailed, even though we were snatched from our homeland. Our rights and privileges were taken away from us. We were treated like cattle, yet we still prevailed. They were not able to annihilate us. Why is that? It was because of our faith and our resolve. And if you look at what happened with emancipation and during Reconstructions, the black community as a whole set records that have yet to be duplicated and surpassed in history. Here's one that really grabs me. We were emancipated. Reconstruction takes off. The majority of the black community in America could not read or write because we had been slaves. It was something like only 10 to 15% of blacks could even read and write. And in the ensuing years after that, 45, 50 years, the black community went from being almost completely illiterate to being almost completely literate. We founded our own colleges and institutions, founded our own schools, founded our own denominations and churches, founded our own communities where we could not be assimilated into the mainline community. We founded our own. And I say, how did we do that? Well, for me, I'm a faith-based person. When we look at it, was our inheritance Christianity. It's some of the biggest black denominations today, AME, CME, EME denominations, were founded because we found a way in spite of. And I think it's our faith that allowed us to do that. Today, we're in dire straits across America, in every urban city across America, and I just use Chicago as an instance. You know, there's more people shot and killed in Chicago that happen to be black than all the folks that have been killed and are shot and maimed in Afghanistan and Iraq combined.
Right.
And those
yeah.
are war zones.
So, with all this violence in our communities, with the gangs, with the shootings, do you really feel that it is because that these individuals have a lack of understanding or have a lack of faith within themselves and possibly their families?
No. No, the reason for what you see happening in our inner cities today is attributable to one thing. Lack of paternal influence in the community. The dads have been removed from the home. I was just at a big conference here in D.C. They had subject matter experts from all over the nation that talked about the statistics that were taking place in our community. Today, 75% of black households in urban America are single parent, typically
right.
female head of household. There's no dads around, not like they used to be. I've been around a little bit. I'm from Southern California. I grew up in a community where, in my neighborhood, you can count on one hand how many divorced families there were in the entire neighborhood. Today, that same neighborhood reflects those statistics where 75%+ of households are single parent. Right here in Washington, D.C., brother, in Southeast D.C., called Anacostia, which is right across the river from the White House. It's the hood, right? It's where our people are.
Mm-hmm.
That number is about 90%. 90% of black households are single parent. There's no
you
dad.
Say nine families out of 10 are
yep.
without any paternal influence?
You heard it right, brother. I got the data. This was produced in 2015 by the MARI Research, which is Marriage and Religion Research Institute. It's part of one of the foremost social policy centers here in Washington, D.C. And the numbers, and I'll get that information out to you so that your listeners can have it as well. And it states, and this was from 2015, so I had to project it forward a little bit, 89.7% in 2015. That number's gone up. It's 90%. You just look. I live
yeah.
right here in the belly of the beast in D.C. in the swamp. I see it every day. All you see is mamas with babies, and you don't see no daddies around. Daddies click it in their own clicks. It's just, and I grew up in L.A. I can't tell you where I saw that in L.A. You didn't see that in the projects.
No, you didn't.
No. So the dads were removed from the home. There's a direct correlation between the entitlement programs implemented in the mid-1960s, and it was called Lyndon Baines Johnson's Great Society Program. And
right.
From that point going forward, black males removed from their prominence in the home. Because remember, mama could go on welfare and get that check, but daddy couldn't be there.
Do you
remember
think
the movie Claudine was about that very thing?
Right. Yeah, I remember that movie. Do you think
yep.
that it is by design that the black man is removed from the house? No. Let me change that. Do you think it's by design that the black man is removed from the community because there's 1.5 million black fathers that are in prison? Do you think that is by design?
Yes, it is by design. And let me tell you why, in my opinion. As I mentioned prior, slavery did not break the back of the black community. In fact, if you look at the statistics, after slavery and during Reconstruction, when families were separated because of slavery, guess what the fathers did after they were freed? They went and found their family. I mean, they found their wives. They found their children. Now, they didn't have the internet. So it took some time, sometimes years, but they found their loved ones. During the Great Depression, the black community was more intact than our white brothers and sisters. These are all documented facts. 70+ percent, I'm using average numbers, but 70+ percent of black households were intact two-parent households that daddy was home. He might not have had the best job. He might have been discriminated against, but he was there. So he did what he had to do. You're a garbage man. He worked as a custodian. Whatever he had to do, he was there. If you look at what took place from 1960, the implementation of the Great Society programs of Lyndon Baines Johnson, I believe it was the Voting Rights Act was 1964. The Civil Rights legislation, I believe, was 1965, which was a good thing. At the same time, 65, the entitlement programs from the Great Society program signed by Lyndon Baines Johnson took effect, and that's when you begin to see the slides from 1965 going forward up to 1975, 1980. You started to see a switch. I remember the community I grew up in. I grew up in Inglewood. By the time my parents moved from Inglewood in 1980, I remember seeing, just as they sold the house and moved, the community had changed. I'm not talking about in terms of its prominence and being a beautiful black community. It was that. But I noticed there were a lot more households where dad wasn't there. So I would say, yes, by design, it was designed to break up the black family. Now, here's where I throw rocks. Who designed this? Who implemented these programs to hamstring the black community? And is there a cause for screaming racism? I would say, you know, taking a knee on the national anthem accomplishes nothing. If you want to look at the culprit, what happened to us as a people, look no further than who implemented those programs. You know who Daniel Patrick Moynihan is?
Yes, I know who Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Matter of fact, he did a documentary on generational welfare recipients within the black community back in the mid-70s.
Yep. It came out in the early to mid-70s. He wrote the Moynihan Report. He was a white Irish Catholic Democrat, but he saw what was happening to the black community, and he pushed back on the implementation of those programs, and they vilified and ostracized him as a racist. You know, he's gone on to be with the Lord, but the man was prophetic, and he saw what was happening, and I think I understand why he saw it, even though he was a Democrat, even though he was supposed to be pro-black and stuff. He was, but he pushed back on his Democratic brethren and said, this will not do any good for the black community. Well, they ran him out on a rail, both blacks and whites. Today, his conviction has come completely true.
But he was right. If you look at it today, in fact, I'm going to say this, and I don't mean to mobilize the conversation because this is your platform this evening. But I just want to just interject one thing that he was right, and you see the results today that what happens to a family when they're on Medicaid or when they're welfare recipients, and also we stereotype because we only make up 26% of the welfare rolls, 46 to 48% make up. Are from our white brothers and sisters that's on the welfare rolls. So this stereotype had latched on to us, and sometimes we feed into the stereotype.
Yeah, the issue is, and I agree with you, the issue is we're disproportionately represented. You know, we don't have the numbers that the white community has in general. Man, we're only, 13% of the population.
Right.
But we represent disproportionately more on the welfare rolls. Because the welfare roles were targeted us, you know, and so that's why it's having a greater impact on us. Now, here's the elephant in the room. We're in depopulation today across America. Depopulation. We've had strong growth in the black community going all the way back to Reconstruction and the great migration of southern blacks to the north for jobs, like coming from Mississippi and going to Chicago and Detroit and those areas to get those jobs, those industry jobs, automotive industry, and so forth, had strong growth in those communities. Today, we are in depopulation, and the elephant in the room, and the black communities to get a firm understanding and hold on this, is abortion. We are aborting our babies. In New York City, more black babies are aborted than born. It's something neighborhood about close to 70%, 67, 68%, of black babies conceived are aborted. So we don't even have the numbers. Okay, we got the Latino community. I don't know if you're from Southern California. I'm from the West Coast, from L.A.
The Latino I'm from New York.
Okay.
I'm from New York.
From that other perspective. Yeah. So if you look at the black community in New York, you look at the black community in L.A., and what are they being pressured? The pressure on the bottom from the illegal immigrant community coming into those communities, taking jobs, housing, education, and health care. So blacks got to compete on that level. For the first time in history, there are more Latinos, and I'll be specifically either South American or Mexican descent, in California than there are black Americans, where we used to be the number one minority. So we've been eclipsed. And our numbers are depleting. So we have no political clout. And we don't have political clout because we don't have the numbers. I read a study that said that if the black babies that had been aborted since Roe v. Wade in 1973 had been allowed to live and procreate, today they would be in their 40s, 30s and 40s, right? And have children themselves, the black population would be somewhere north of 70 million. Today, the black community is somewhere around 37, 38 million.
So half our population
is
aborted.
Yeah. We're being aborted right out of existence. And, in fact, at the rate that we're going, if we don't get a handle on this as black Americans, we won't get another 40 years, bro.
Well, why are there so many women there are in support? You know what, brother? You have somebody that want to ask you a question.
Sure.
Good evening. Welcome to Black Urban America.
Good evening, Kenneth. Good evening, Nani. This is Dominique from Atlanta.
Hey, how you feeling, Dominique?
How you doing? Doing pretty good. How about you guys?
I'm doing okay.
Hey, man, we haven't talked in a long time. It's been, what, 2-3 years?
It's been on Facebook, but I remember you had your show on, the station in Washington, D.C. So, yeah, you know, we got to reconnect sometime.
We sure do.
And I thank Kenneth for the opportunity when he told me about this, because I got very excited. And you guys are really talking some good stuff right now with this abortion and the factors that are going on with the black community. I'm sure you may have heard about the fiasco that happened last week with very smart brothers with the straight black men on the white people for black people. And then you had a response from the Huffington Post, a woman responded. And then there was another response back on very smart brothers. And then Madame Noir had a piece. So it was a lot of stuff within the millennial cohort with all this gender warfare. And I think the gender warfare has really come to a fever pitch among black millennials now. And I think, and I hate to be negative to say, you know, many young black guys, they're tied to misandry. They're at the point now, they're not even checking for sisters anymore. And I know that's bad, that's ugly.
I noticed that.
And I think, to Lonnie's point, I think time is up. I think you're going to see a black mix with white, Asian, Filipino, whoever now, as the new minority, because I think in some cases, these studies have said that the average black, like 73% of black women, and I don't have the source there for me, but it's like a high percentage of black women are with child and unmarried, compared to 40% of black men who are with child and unmarried. 60% of sisters who have multiple children have multiple children by multiple men. And from a male standpoint, who wants to be bothered with that? And I know from the woman's standpoint, it's that the average black man has either a criminal conviction, either a misdemeanor or a felony. Black men are not in the workforce because of their backgrounds, last hired, first fired, affirmative action. So it's really at the point now to where black men and black women, I think, are at the point now where I think we're just going to shake hands and say it was nice knowing you. We'll go our separate ways. What do you fellas think about that?
Go ahead, brother Lyon.
I think you hit the nail on the head. It's the logical conclusion when you have societal or familial breakdown. It's just what takes place. As I'm sure you know, the other new thing that's taking place that you see within our communities, and this is pushed by the liberal community, the white side, and then supported by a portion of those in the black community, gay is the new black. So you got black men who are just walking completely away from heterosexual relationships. Then you have other black men that are walking away from black women. Then you have, because what you end up dealing with is many black men is they have to deal with, and let me just point out for the record, I love black women. My mama's a black woman. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I love them too.
Today is no black men that have the wherewithal to want to do something and accomplish something, and I'm generalizing here, so forgive me, they don't want to be bothered. They want to deal with, okay, I got to deal with you. I got to deal with your baby daddy, and I also have to deal with the government. All of them got their hands up in our relationship, so why should I deal with this? I get this a lot because I do a lot of counseling to a lot of men across the country. I deal with pastors quite a bit. It's all because the government's all up in the black community and needs to get the heck out so that, as Star Parker would say, so that Taquan has to deal with Shaniqua as opposed to having gone through the government to do so. And they work together to keep the family units together, to raise up their children and so forth. Now, it's just, I can't deal with this behind. I'm pissed off at him, to give the French. And then I don't need to worry about him because I know that check's going to show up on the 1st and the 15th anyway. But let me get back to something that is really on my heart that pertains to all of this. This is a concerted effort and an agenda to break the black family and black community down. It is an agenda, but let me tell you who the bad guys are, for lack of a better term. There's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Patrick Fagan. He's one of the foremost demographic experts in studies. I mean, he has more data in his head that he can tell you about what's happening in America per ethnic group, per economic demographic, per community across America. And it's amazing. If you ask him the question, he'll tell you. You know, he'll say, 89.7% in Washington, D.C., single-parent households. If a young black male raises in a single black household and he does not have a father in his life at the age of by 15, by the time he's 25, the likelihood is such and such percentage that he'll do time in a penitentiary. This is the kind of data that he has. He's a white Irish Catholic, and this is what he told me. I said, why do you care so much about the plight of the black community? He says, I care because I saw this take place in Ireland where I'm from. I said, really? Mm. He said, yeah. I saw this take place. He said, so I made it my life's mission. He says, number two, slavery, second-class citizenship, Jim Crow, and the KKK could not break the black community. I said, yeah. He said, but entitlement programs are doing just about that. I said, wow. Then he said this, you're asking me why I care so much. He said, if the black community falls, the rest of America will go with it. And that riveted me. So there is an attack on the black community. And not for the reason that many people think. The attack on the black community is a bigger picture of, if we can break the black community, we can destroy America. And they're hell-bent on doing that.
Well, I read one time when I was a young fella, a long, long time ago, I think it was by Weber, and he said, if you want to destroy a culture or an ethnic group, you have to start with the man. And by imprisoning us, by not educating us, which... I believe I read that every person in this country is entitled to a free education. But when that education is not equal to other culture that received other culture education process, then we have a problem. You cannot tell me that most of our boys belong in special education. You cannot tell me why I believe it's close to 68 to 70% of black males drop out of the drop out of high school. And then, are they preparing them by educating them with marketable skills that can make them succeed in society, that can make them care for their family, their children, and their communities? So to me, that really all ties in to there's an attack on the black family. As a matter of fact, it's an attack on the black man, and it has not stopped. In my view, It has not stopped.
No, I agree. I agree. It has not stopped, and it's had a devastating impact on our communities. And it's why you see, you know, let's talk about gangs. Okay, I grew up in Southern California. The Crips and the Bloods came up around there. I'm a 70s child, so I saw it all when it came together. I actually had some dealings with Tookie Williams and the rest of them back in the day, and a few knots on the back of my head to represent my interaction with them. But let's talk about that. Why do you have gangs? You have gangs, and you can say it's economic factor, you can say it's racism, you can say whatever you want to say that it is. But at the end of the day, all gangs are roving bands of unsupervised male youth, mostly black, we're talking about our people, with no paternal influence. Because the reason why I was not in a gang, because my dad would kick my butt if I tried to. One time I went to my mother. Crips had a particular uniform they liked to wear. It was khaki pants, khaki work shirt, and these shoes back in the day, they call them croquet sacks. I don't know if they call them where y'all from. And so I went to my mother one day, and I said, Mom, and here I'm trying to be slick. I go over to Western Surplus, and we could save money on getting my school clothes, and because they got a great deal. You can get khaki trousers for $10, and the shirts were like $7, $8. It was the 70s, right? And I can get the shoes. And so my mother looked at me, and she says, what in the world, why do you want to wear khaki pants or a khaki shirt? Well, and I'm trying to explain to her why it would be cost effective. Well, my mother was not stupid. And so she said, you're not wearing that stuff today. That's what those gang members wear. So my father came home, and my father came and said, boy, come here. Please sit down and talk to you. He says, why do you want to be in a gang? I don't want to be in a gang, Dad. He says, well, why do you want to dress like a gang member? Well, it's because it's cool. He says, I don't give a H-A blah, blah, blah why it's cool. You're a Poindexter, and Poindexters carry themselves this way, that way, and he went right down the line of who we are as a family. He says, I'm not having that up in here. And then he sent me on my way. Well, what he just did there is he blocked me from doing something stupid that could have got me caught up. Number two, he taught me the value of what it was to be a member of our family and what that meant. And number three, he showed me leadership, masculine leadership. So I didn't do it. I had some friends that did it, but I didn't do it. If Dad's not in the home, these boys are out there. And you talk to them. I mean, we do some gang intervention stuff with some of the programs I work with. And you talk to the lion's share of those young men. They say, if I had a father around or an uncle or a granddad or somebody, I wouldn't have gotten half the foolishness I got in.
And you hear it a lot on the Scared Straight show when you look at those inmates who talk to the young boys to tell them, I wish somebody had gotten my case, like I'm getting in your case, to where I wouldn't have gotten this trouble. And parenting is a two-person job. And I think we have gotten so caught up in, you know, glorifying the single parenthood and the black community, glorifying co-parent. But when the children are chaotic, then you corrupt them. And now that's where the problems are continuing, because children get the sense that they're unwanted. They see mommy and daddy arguing all the time. You're handling your child as a UPS package. I always cringe when I watch the child do what I call walk the plank from one car to the other car. The parents, they even look at each other and ain't no love or conversation. It's just going to where dad gets them on the weekend and mom gets them during the week, or in the case of some of these women I often hear from on my end, where they say, well, it's always an excuse when it's time for the dad to get the child. Oh, I got to work. Oh, this, oh, that. And then that takes into effect. And we get mad because the child now goes to these street games. The child now, because they're facing these minimum wage increase in liberalism, nobody's hiring these teenagers, giving them a chance. Teenagers need money. These young boys, you're tired watching mama struggle. So they want to do something to help because they hungry and all this type of stuff. So guess what they do? They start breaking into houses. And when you look at these crimes, they're not heinous crimes in many cases. They're taking laptops, jewelry, money, little things that they're looking to get cash so they can pay bills, eat, and survive. And now what's happening, because of the point system here in Georgia, is as an adult, they take me straight to jail for breaking into a house. As a 15-year-old, they don't take you to jail. They just call your parents. So we look at how many points you have. So if I get these kids and say, hey, I give you $50 a house, we'll hit 10 houses today, and that's nothing for Burbank. They can hit 10 houses in an hour and a half if they hit them right. Yep. And I say, I'm no criminal. This is just criminals I've talked to in the past. So that's $500 for that kid. What you can't get that frying French fries at McDonald's. So it's economics. It's the root cause of all this dysfunction among our people, especially with men and women. You know, black women, as much as they don't want to admit it, they do believe in some forms of patriarchy. If a man ain't paying no bills, if a man ain't providing, if a man ain't needing to know what, I can do bad by myself, if they say them Tyler Perry things. And brothers have got to get that memo.
And also, gentlemen, you got to look at our value system. You know, our value system had changed over the past 40 to 50 years. And like you said, although you said, Dominique or Lonnie, that it's fashionable now to be in the game. It's fashionable to have a baby daddy, be a single parent.
Yep.
It's fashionable to wait for the first to the third for the check. We have, I feel that it's getting there slowly, but we have to really sometimes go back to the fundamentals of part of our value system and teaching our young. I mean, we have to really understand about family values, which is a big topic in the conservative thinking. Family values, work ethic. You know, most of our kids don't know anything about applying for a job or better yet, they don't see people in their community get up early in the morning going to work.
Preach.
Which is images. Images. We have to change some of these negative images. Huh? We have to change some of these negative images. Huh?
I would say you don't even see some of your friends that are your age, they skipping school. You going to school with your friends and they're saying, I ain't going today. My mom said, I don't have to go to school. My dad said, I don't have to go. My uncle said, he don't care if I go or not. Especially these
kids. How about this, guys? They don't even have to skip school. They stay home and skip school. They don't even, their mothers don't even force them to go to school because she might need his or her help to take care of his youngest siblings. The value system had to change. And I just want to say one thing before I turn it back over to y'all. I worked in a certain industry for 35 years that's supposed to help families. Now, I was at a workshop. This person going to this family home every week, once a week. And this is a married couple. And she was continually work with the mom. And one day she asked, this is a year later, going every week. She said, oh, who's that man that I see all the time? Oh, that's my husband. You mean to tell me you're married? We are not even recognized by society as being a husband, a father, or whatever title you want to put on us. We're not even recognized by other entities of what or who we are in our own communities.
You see the now?
Yeah, it's being touted now that it's not something we do. It's not part of black culture. And it just makes me want to throw something at the TV or scream at the top of my lungs. What are you talking about? We were – everything that supposedly is attributed to the white community, black community was doing, and then some. If you look at the history and you look at the data, let me tell you just a quick story because folks need to understand why I believe what I believe and why I stand the way I stand. I was raised up in a two-parent household, a mother and a father. Thank God they're still with me today. They're up in age, but they're still with me today. My father's background, my father was raised without a father. My father's from dirt poor Mississippi. And so I'm talking Jim Crow, separate but equal, KKK, all that's a part of his background. Mm-hmm. His mother had a seventh grade education. My dad was the oldest of five kids. My grandmother, single mom, because her husband, my father's father, abandoned them in Mississippi back in the 40s. My grandmother, with a seventh grade education, had the wherewithal to move all five of her kids from Mississippi to California to give them better opportunities. Whole nother story about how that happened. It's an amazing story. She did it by herself. She was about 5'1", 5'2", little bitty lady. She got a job at the shipyards in Northern California, so she was a Rosie the Riveter back during World War II. She sent for all five of her kids when she got established. She went there first and got all five of her kids to California. She bought a home in the 40s, single mom, five kids, no welfare, no Section 8, no WIC, none of that foolishness that's out there. She did it on her own with the help of the church. Now, here's where the story gets interesting. After the war, there were no more jobs. She lost the house, and she moved all five of her kids to Central California, and they lived in a tent with a wooden floor, and they picked fruits and vegetables with the migrant workers. That's humble, right? So I asked my father, I said, "Dad, did you know you were poor?" And he said, "No." He said, "Well," he had to think of it. He said, I guess we were poor. He said, "But we didn't look at it that way." I said, "Well, how'd you see it?" He said, "We were all together, and we all loved one another. My mom made sure we had something to eat every day. Sometimes it was just the basics that we ate. We had one pair of shoes for church, and we had and we were barefoot during the summer because you didn't want to mess up your shoes because you had to hand them down to your younger brother." So I said, "Wow." I said, "Okay, Dad, was there any crime?" He said, "No." I said, "Everybody that was living in them tents, them farm workers and so forth, there was no crime." He said, "No." He said, "Because nobody had nothing, and if there was any crime, everybody knew it was probably Bobby. It was maybe one individual." So I said, "How did you come to the understanding you have today?" My father became a very successful entrepreneur and did in corporate America back during the 60s and 70s and 80s. I said, "How did you do that?" He said, "My mama taught me faith in God, focus on my goals, and ignoring the peripheral." And he had to call up a word. He called it BS. I said, "What's that, Dad?" He said, "Racism, bigotry, and anybody that tells you that you can't because they won't let you. Because, so son, if you're on racism and bigotry, all it will do is make you bitter." I said, "So that's your secret?" He said, "Yeah, my mama taught me that, your grandmother." Now, they were not unique, because all of my father's peers in the military, because in the military as well, all of them had that ethic. That's our true culture as a people. We overcome in spite of the crap they throw at us. But today, we're a culture of victimhood, and it drives me crazy because we are great and powerful as a people. Slavery did not destroy us, but I'm telling you, this victimhood mentality might certainly do so. I'm sorry, brothers. Y'all got me preaching.
Oh, yeah, that's some good stuff. I mean, this victimhood mentality is the favorite game. I call it the oppression Olympics. I gleaned that term from a white feminist a couple of years ago. Uh-huh. And it's like we're so caught up in, you know, who has it the worst. And it's to the point we're even arguing that among each other. Black men, black women, black gay, black disabled, black whoever are all trying to race towards the bottom of who is the most oppressed by society. I'm like, that's not a conversation that normal people should be having. That's like Michael Faber says, liberalism is a mental illness, to the point where you have images to where you see the white couple, Asian couple, Chinese couple, man, woman, child. Black people, you see woman and child. And I noticed that with an ad on the subway system here in Atlanta where they was in the south side, the black folks, so it was the woman and the child talking about the housing program you get through trying to repopulate the city, and when you up in the northern suburbs, you saw the white family. And I'm going to take pictures of that and do an article about that for my magazine, because that, and I'm telling black men, you got to start recognizing this is by design. They're pushing you out the picture to where that's where they want you to go to at. And we have to ask ourselves as men, do we continue to allow this? Or do we continue to do whatever? I mean, even if certain brothers get with non-black women, at least build a family. Build something that you can pass down, because Jason Black said it best in his documentary 2014, 7 a.m., that most young black people realize they're inheriting nothing. That's why they're wilding out. You know, so the average black child has nothing to look forward to. The house is a six-man house or it's an apartment. You know, mom and daddy, uncle, auntie, whoever, all road public transit. Like, get all these hoopty cars, all those junk cars on the side of the house so that, that you hope to say don't make you get towed out of there. So we lost our sense of belonging along the way. And this is for me a feminist, but heads at, I blame this on the sexual revolution of the 70s, a.k.a. the right to twerk, as I call it, in modern-day times, to where we're so caught up in sexual liberation that we have forsaken economic empowerment. Okay, that's great. Ladies, I know you're glad now you got to cover yourself up. You can show your cleavage. Mm-hmm. You can do whatever you want to. You get you a job, get you a degree. You know, most men will support, you know, women being equal on that respect. They can earn an income. They can have a business or whatever have you. But now we're looking at the point now, you got that, but look at what you gave up in the process. Not saying that you should need to go back to being barefoot and pregnant. Okay, you got this degree, but now you are a single mother, which means the wealth that you could have been generating in a family is now diminished, and now you're playing catch-up to a white woman, or Becky, as they like to call it. You're playing catch-up to her because she has a husband. They're sharing the load. They use their feminism to demand more money, which is the way how it should have been used. And now we're looking at, guys, some men got three kids by three different women. How are you building wealth? What are you leaving these kids? I mean, it's just, it all goes back to economics.
Well, I just want to say something about the feminist movement. The feminist movement originally wasn't for the sisters. You know, the feminist movement was really for white women because sisters always worked. Always worked. My mom worked. My grandma worked. You know, they always worked. So it's like the feminist movement was really for white women, and they really benefit from more than any other minority for the civil rights movement. But from the action, because now these women got just, especially sisters, if you look at it, I was going to ask you this too, entrepreneurship, since you brought up that, Dominique, more sisters now are really trying to get into becoming more entrepreneurs than brothers.
Right.
And I asked a couple weeks ago, I had somebody on the show, I said, how come you don't want to do anything with the brothers? You said, we have to think about ourselves first. Even our own sisters are counting us out. You talk about the two-parent family and how other society looking at us or whatnot and not really making us feel a part of our own culture. Even our own sisters are counting us out. And maybe that's one of the reasons why we're looking for women from other cultures, because we can't get the respect from our own.
Oh, yeah.
What you guys think about entrepreneurship as a solution to some of our social ills?
Entrepreneurship was what allowed us to survive second-class citizenship in America. It was because we had our own communities. Think about it. If you could not be prevalent in general society, you created your own communities, and entrepreneurship was the centerpiece of that. And in the middle of all that was the church. So, you know, we had our own doctors and dentists. We had our own cobblers for shoes or mechanics, whatever it happened to be. And that's all built around entrepreneurship. Today, you just said a powerful statement, brother, that, black women increasingly are looking for entrepreneurship. And there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is, the core issue is they feel they don't need a man. And that's the core issue.
Let me say, since the late 80s.
If they don't need a man, it's because they came from an environment where daddy probably wasn't around. It's generational. So you've got a generation of women today who were raised by a generation of women who did not have men prominent in their lives, so they don't feel they need them. But you and I both know, or the three of us know, that they pay a price for that. God says it's male and female. That's what society is built upon, and children are the offspring. You can't do one or the other, because here's the deal. Somebody ends up being the surrogate daddy. Star Parker likes to say government's the new daddy in the black community, and I agree with him. And government needs to get the hell up out of the black community.
Yeah, agree. And see that our culture, our people is so dependent on the government for everything. Whenever there's a problem in our community, we run to City Hall, we run to the State House, or we run to Congress, or the and we come there with nothing in hand. Why you think nobody messes with the Asians? Why you think nobody messes with Middle Eastern? Because they come to the table with something in hand, with some type of capital, with some type of thought. We come to the table with nothing in hand, and I think that we got to take more responsibility for gentrification, because like gentrification is another problem that hit in a lot of African American communities across the United States.
Gentrifying parts of D.C. And the culprit is, because I have brothers in there, take everything. The rents are going through the roof. I said, how come we don't own nothing in these communities? See, we rent.
Yeah, we rent. We got to start owning. Buying property.
Yeah, when they gentrify, you got to go.
Yeah. And Harlem is gone. Bedford-Stuyvesant is gone. D.C., I heard D.C. is gone. There's no more Chocolate City. And let me tell you, Atlanta is next.
Oh, it's pretty much Atlanta's done, because I'm gonna tell you why. when the historical landmarks such as the Herndon Building, you know, since the Trust Bank, so it's a black bank, they don't have their building no more. They don't even have a bank branch downtown. They're now in a smaller space off Peachtree Street, which is our main road, main thoroughfare. That building is now owned by Georgia State University. The Atlanta Lights Building, which was created by a black insurance company, that's now owned by Georgia State University. What Atlanta Delta Word newspaper used to be at, that is now a white-owned smoothie shop is in there now, and a coffee shop. So a lot of the businesses are being torn down. They're building condos. And guess what you're seeing? You're seeing non-black people move over there and a lot of the businesses. Now it's looking like a suburban area now. And I'm saying us as a people that we, Atlanta's had all this black leadership. People are so worried that we may get a white mayor this go around. We came 715 votes shy.
I think that's what's going to happen. I think the white mayor is going to be the next mayor. I think that's going to happen.
It is, because that's why they created that new city in the south side to block them from annexing that land. They want to bring in more of the land on the north side. So I tell our people, they're playing chess while we're sitting here playing hopscotch. These folks got all the pieces that we're doing all together. That where they're coming into your neighborhood, they're coming up with trendy names. And like taking Boulevard is now the Avenue. Boulevard is the hood. Oh, it's the avenue now. So
okay, we got 1 minute left. Brother Lonnie, would you like to sum up anything?
Sure, I appreciate it. First of all, let me thank you, Kenny, for allowing me to come on your wonderful show and program. It's truly an honor to be able to participate. And
it's an honor to have you, my brother.
It's an honor to have you. Timing in is. Well, because I've been following his post for years, I'm excited because when three men get together and iron sharpens iron and speaks to our core issues, and we can show that we can come from different places, different walks of life and everything, and understand what's really going on in our nation. And I'm encouraged that we can right this ship called America. In particular, we can turn the tide in Black America.
Okay. Hey, thank you for calling in, Brother Dominique. And Brother Lonnie, thank you for coming on my show. And I hope you will return in a few months, because we really did get through half of the subject core issues that I want to talk to you about.
All right.
So y'all brothers have a nice week.
Oh, you do the same. It's great conversation.
Okay. And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Another week. Wow. We really touched on a lot of issues.
You will not be able to stay home, brother.
He got to get back in.
You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on the gag and skip out the beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised.